The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 11.
Chapter 83. The Gulfstream hit the tarmac of the Moss Riga Airport, only about 30 minutes away from Fredrikstad, and I immediately began issuing orders, basically repeating what I'd already said. But hell, that's what leaders do, repeat shit over and over. Okay, we have no idea what we're doing here, so I need a split evacuation of the aircraft. I want both long guns and surveillance kit. We might be going offensive, or we might just be tagging and tracking. When the customs guys get here, Brett handles them. We're members of Groya Recovery Service, and we're here to look at the fortifications of Old Town Fredrikstad. That's all you need to say. Knuckles had already moved to the rear of the aircraft and had begun making a list of what to remove after customs was through with their inspection. Nick said, I'm not really read into the whole cover story of Grolier. I can't fake it. I said, just fake the fact that we hired you for aircraft purposes. You can do that with your Air Force background. Anyone asks you in-depth questions about GRS, you point at Jennifer and tell them she's the spokesperson. You're just the hired help. He said, how is that going to solve anything? I looked at Jennifer with a help me here glance. I knew she'd studied up as soon as she learned where we were going. She said, Fredrikstad was originally founded in the 1500s by King Frederick II. The old town is the finest European example of a fortified city. It was originally built. I waved a hand, cutting her off. I said, trust me, she can talk the talk. Knuckles issued orders, organizing the loadout, knowing the pressure we were under. He got the team moving, doing what they could before immigration showed up, then sat down across from me, looking for answers. Answers I didn't have. He said, what's the play here? What are we doing? I said, Knuckles, you're asking for a miracle with that question. I don't know. You heard my conversation with Blaine. He doesn't even know. I'd spent the night getting one data dump after another from the task force, all indicating something evil, but outside of the term Shahid. Nothing specifically pointed to a smoking gun. The thumb drives had showed unequivocally that the Al-Attiyah clan was involved in some seriously bad activities, but none of it involved what we'd call actionable intelligence. There were a lot of potential connections to both past and future operations, but no black and white order to kill the Secretary of State or blow up the peace talks. No outright proof of malevolent actions, which is really what always occurred. No terrorist in his right mind talked about his actions in the open, at least no terrorist who wanted to live beyond a day and a half. It was all innuendo, requiring massive cross-checks and linkage exploration. After the initial analysis of the data, we had a ton of smoke, which would have been good enough to continue watching the QIA team, but not solid proof for anything more than that. With the exception of one thing, the word Shahid. It was an Arab term meaning witness, but had, in the modern jihadi world, evolved into someone who died fulfilling a religious obligation, someone who had become a martyr in the course of jihad. And it had been used as the notation beside the fake Afghanistan airport. It could only mean one thing. He was going to kill himself for Islam, meaning he was going to kill more than just himself. And so Kurt had got us moving without a mission. Once airborne, I'd called Blaine, himself flying out of Washington, D.C. He was the officer in charge of Omega operations, but we hadn't yet been given that authority, so it was a little strange. But I'd be lying if I didn't say I was happy Kurt had sent him. He was a backstop I might potentially need. He'd answered the call mid-flight saying, so I guess I'm heading into operations with my favorite team. Thank heavens for that. I'd laughed because he'd said that to every team he was going to control. Then I countered with, I'm not so sure about that. From what I hear, the Army is giving you your walking papers. Not sure I want to be under the command of someone who can't even get promoted. He said, it's already done. I'm on terminal leave right now. It could cause a conflict of interest, since I'm working a government job paid for by the Oversight Council while still on active duty. Hard to say if anyone will pay attention to a lowly lieutenant colonel, though. I took that in, trying to make sense of it, then said, "Sir, the army really pulled the trigger? Fired you?" He said, "Well, yes and no. I took Kurt's option. I'm now a civilian like you. But if you think I'll take your shit because of it, you're sorely mistaken." That brought a grin, because he'd been covering my butt for years for things I'd done, taking more than his fair share of pike trouble. I said, "That's the best possible solution. Welcome to the real world. You ready to slay some monsters?" He said, "Oh yeah, but I'm not sure that's what we're looking at." I said, "We're looking at a clown who received a fake passport to kill people. It's pretty clear." Blaine said, "Yeah, I'm with you, but the attack may be months from now. I mean, why give him an Afghanistan passport? Maybe they're prepping him for that theater. Why bring him to Norway then? Where the peace talks are happening." I heard my voice rising as I talked and regretted it. I needed to remain unemotional. Blaine said, "Pike, I hear you. But you're forgetting that we control Billings. He has an entire diplomatic security team there. We've been in contact with Billings, and he's read on to the threat." "What's that mean in real terms?" "It means there is no immediate threat. The only immediate threat is the peace talks, and they won't be allowed to go to them. Best case, we've solved the problem with a phone call. Worst case, Billings has a threat against him personally, but we have the men there to neutralize any attempt. They have the ball. Honestly, I don't see this as a task force mission. I'm glad to play, but I don't think we're worth putting on the field." I said, maybe you're right. But you're forgetting what Billings is like. Forgetting what he's done in the past. That ass clown will neutralize his own security. Pike, come on, he might be a jerk, but he's not going to let them get near the meetings. He's got marching orders from the President of the United States." "So they're going to arrest the guys from Qatar when they show up?" "No, hell no, of course not. What proof do we have to do that? Nothing. A thumb drive from a bank we never entered. Secretary Billings doesn't even believe the evidence we have, and he's certainly not going to explode open the peace talks with allegations of infiltration of a Qatari suicide team." I'd taken that in, which was about what I'd expected. I said, "So we're back at square one." "Well, yeah, except I'm in the air, and you're about to be on the ground. I'll be an hour behind you. You can call that square one, but I call it endgame." I disconnected the call and rode the aircraft into the tarmac, ignoring the stares from the team. Now on the ground, Knuckles was asking a valid question. What the hell were we doing? Our conversation was interrupted by the arrival of the immigration officials, forcing all of us into cover mode, answering their questions politely. Led around by Brett, my crew went through the usual pathetic customs inventory that anyone gets as a chartered aircraft in a European city, and the men left satisfied that we were who we said we were. Knuckles got the team moving, breaking open panels on the interior of the aircraft that exposed a host of James Bond surveillance kit, along with our lethal tools in case surveillance turned into assault. Satisfied the team was executing his orders, he sat back down facing me. "Pike, I understand the pressure, but you've got to give us some focus here. Talking long guns and surveillance isn't cutting it." The question was valid. I thought about my response, and Guy's face appeared out of nowhere, demanding the same answer. I realized I didn't care about protecting Billings or the peace talks. I wanted vengeance, pure and simple. Knuckles saw the change, recognized where I was. He said, "Pike, are we sure about this? Don't let Guy's death cause you to make a decision you'll regret. Maybe Billings is right for once." I sat for a moment, quelling the beast. A strange thing that was now a part of my essence, but something that I'd learned to control almost at will. Almost. Knuckles said, "Pike." I said, "Okay, for starters, we'll just deploy to the secretary's location. We'll get eyes on the targets and continue with our alpha mission. Surveil them for follow-on operations. It'll probably be nothing. Billings agreed not to take them to the meetings. Problem solved. But I didn't believe it, and neither did the Beast. From the data we'd found, I knew the Arab I'd fought in Greece was here, and he was looking for trouble. We finished the loadout, all equipment stowed in innocuous suitcases, and moved to the rental car counters. I told Knuckles to get 2 cars, not that we needed the space, but because we might need the flexibility. I saw a counter for motorcycle tours, advertising BMW bikes for running around the fjords. I said, "Veep, you've done mobility stuff in your units, right?" He quit fidgeting with his bag and said, "Yeah, why?" "You do any biking there, in the Special Tactics Squadron?" "All the time." Knuckles came back with the keys to 2 vehicles, one a van, the other a sedan. Brett was standing next to me, and I knew he could do what I was asking of Nick. I said, "How about renting 2 of those Beamers for a few days, you and Brett?" Knuckles said, "Why?" I said, "Because I want the flexibility. I don't believe a word I said to you earlier. I don't care what Billings thinks. Those assholes are here for a reason, and the fight is coming to us."
Chapter 84. From his facial expression, Khalid was bored, but his heel unconsciously rapping on the hardwood floor gave away his anxiety. Every few seconds, he glanced reflexively at the closed doors Secretary Billings and Hyder had disappeared behind, waiting on the outcome. The security man with the indoor sunglasses sat stoically 1 chair over, glancing at the door as often as Khalid. For her part, the assistant Leslie ignored them both, tapping away on a laptop. Khalid stood, startling the security man. He rose as well. Khalid said, "I don't know what's taking so long. What's this about?" The man said, "Just routine. They'll be out soon." Khalid smiled and said, "Because we're Arabs, right?" The man shook his head and said, "No, not at all." "Can I get you something to drink? We have soda, coffee, or water." Khalid said, "Yes, actually, if it's not too much of a bother, I'll have a glass of water." The man left the room, and Khalid considered asking Leslie about the meeting, but decided he'd got the same answer. So far, nobody had shown any outward animosity, but that meant little. He heard the security man's footsteps in the kitchen, then saw the office door open. Hyder came out first, his eyes fearful, darting left and right. Not good. Secretary Billings followed him through the door, looking almost comically stern and authoritarian. Khalid said, "So? We go now?" Hyder clasped his hands together and said, "No, apparently we've come to Norway for nothing. Secretary Billings has changed his mind on allowing us to help. He now feels it will be counterproductive for us to attend the meetings." Khalid said, "Why?" Secretary Billings said, "It's just the way of things. The representatives of the Afghan High Peace Council don't feel it will be helpful to have members of Qatar observe the talks. I made a mistake. I still believe you can contribute, but I can't go against their wishes." Khalid saw the fear leaking out of Hyder's expression, and knew something else had been said in that room. Hyder said, "Secretary Billings has agreed to reimburse our travel expenses, but this trip was in vain." Khalid saw his new life floating away like a lost balloon released by a child. They were going to fail. He said, "This is ridiculous. We can still simply observe. We flew all the way here." Khalid knew his protest sounded weak and desperate, which was exactly what he didn't want to highlight. But he was desperate. Billings said, "No, I'm sorry. It's not going to happen." The security man returned with his water, sensing something was amiss. He raised the glass, and Khalid made his decision. They would not fail. He reached for the water with both hands, an innocuous gesture. He clamped them on the man's wrist, spilling the water and trapping the hand. He ducked under the arm, rotating it in a direction nature hadn't intended, snapping the joint. The guard screamed in pain, and Khalid slammed his foot into the groin, dropping the man to his knees. He let go of the arm and hammered the guard in the temple. The guard fell forward, unconscious, landing straight on his face. Khalid flipped up the man's suit jacket, revealing a holstered Sig Sauer P-250 pistol. He snatched it and then stood, the entire action taking no more than a few seconds. The two men from the back of the house burst into the room looking for a threat. They found it. Khalid fired twice, hitting each one in the chest and causing them to fall. Leslie shrieked and dropped to the floor. Hyder screamed, "Stop it! Stop it! What are you doing?" Billings looked as if he was going to pass out, his jowls quivering in fear. Khalid said, "We are going to that meeting." With his weapon still raised, Khalid pulled a radio from the unconscious guard's belt and tossed it to Billings. "Call the gate. Tell them that the Range Rover can come forward." Billings said, "I will not." Khalid raised the weapon and said, "This isn't diplomacy. I'm not asking for a debate. It's war. You press that radio button or I'll kill you right here." Hyder jumped between them and said, "Khalid, have you lost your mind? Stop it, stop right now. My father would never want this." Khalid said, "Move away, brother. We aren't really family yet." Hyder raised his arms and said, "No, we aren't doing this. Let's get back to the airport and go home." Khalid gritted his teeth, realizing the dilemma he'd put them in. It was too late for that. They were committed. Stopping now would do nothing but guarantee the loss of his future patronage from Sharif. And yet Sharif's son sought that end in front of him. He said, "Brother, move away." Hyder pressed his hands out in a gesture of surrender and slid forward, saying, "Don't do this. You and I can still fight another day. This isn't the end that you want it to be." Khalid realized that Sharif was correct. His son had no steel, no courage. Hyder was worth more dead than alive as a lever of intimidation for Billings. Khalid pulled the trigger, hitting Hyder just below his left eye. The bullet tracked through his brain, exploding out of the back and whipping by Billings's head, missing the secretary by inches and embedding in the wall. Hyder's brain matter sprayed out, a snap of moisture, as if someone had popped a wet towel, the offal coating Billings in a thick mist. Leslie screamed again, curling up on the floor and covering her head. Billings stood with his mouth open like a fish, shocked, afraid to close it and ingest the gore. Khalid said, "Press the button on the radio, or you will be next."
Chapter 85. After only 30 minutes of tarmac time, our little caravan of vehicles left the airport, heading south toward Frederickstadt. Knuckles and I were up front in the sedan, Brett and Nick on two BMW G650 touring bikes in the middle, and Jennifer in a van bringing up the rear, the back loaded with all of our kit. Knuckles said, "We've got about a 40-minute ride, which means we might beat Blaine to the cottage. You want to go lager outside the town? Burn off some time?" My phone vibrated and I said, "Speak of the devil. Blaine must be on the ground." I answered saying, "About time, showboat. We're inbound. What's your status?" "Waiting on customs. I can see your aircraft, and given what little time it took you to get on the road, I take it they're not that thorough." "No, 30 minutes max." "Did you get any further guidance, or are we still flapping on this thing?" "Still flapping. But I'm sure you've come up with a plan. Oversight Council's working it through Billings. They still haven't given Omega. but they want these guys under close watch. It's a little political, to say the least. Yeah, I figured. Listen, I'm going to need some information from Billings. Okay, like what? I need to know where these guys are staying. I want to put a full blanket on them, bug their rooms, tag their vehicles, and penetrate their communication systems. The usual. Build up a case for Omega, and Billings can help with that. He's still talking to the targets, right? Yeah, but he's a diplomat, Pike. I don't know if I can convince him to use his position as a lever to facilitate task force operations. He'll make decisions as part of the council, but he won't turn into a commando just because you asked. I think it's going to be an issue of principle with him. I only need him to do two things. One, give me the hotel. Two, set up a meeting with his boys, then keep them there for an hour. Half the team will crack into the room while they're meeting. The other half will identify the target vehicles and get a handle on their cellular communications. After that, he's done. It's not like I'm asking him to start slinging lead, and we wouldn't even be in this position if he'd have listened to Guy in the first place. He said, "Let me give it a go. Don't show up at the cottage until I'm done. Seeing you might set him off." "Because he's jealous of my innate skills?" He said, "Because he hates your guts," and hung up. I radioed the team, telling them we were pulling over for a spell. We corralled at a gas station, and I told them what I knew, along with where I envisioned the mission going. We'd been waiting no more than 10 minutes when Blaine called again. I looked at Knuckles and said, "That's either great news, or Billings has told us to pack sand." I answered, saying, "Tell me Billings has decided he'd like to attend assessment and selection." I heard no humor coming back. "Pike, something catastrophic has occurred. I can't get Billings on the phone. I got his assistant, a woman named Leslie, and she's almost catatonic. Get to the cottage ASAP." I circled my hand in the air, telling everyone to load up, then said, "What's happened? What am I walking into?" "I don't know. I need you to figure that out. All she kept shouting was that Secretary Billings was gone and people are dead." Brett and Nick were getting on their bikes when I reversed my command. "Hold up." I looked at Knuckles and said, "Surveillance just went out the window. Kid everyone up for assault. What's going on?" "All I know is that Showboat says there are dead people. We're headed straight to the cottage to sort it out, and we're going armed." His eyes widened slightly, but he said, "Beats the hell out of following those turds for days." He turned away from the hood and waved over Jennifer. "Bring the kid around. We're going in loaded for bear." 5 minutes later, the motorcyclists were each outfitted with a suppressed Glock 23. Knuckles, Jennifer, and I had a primary weapon system MK-109 chambered in 300 blackout, a folding stock AR rifle with a Gemtech suppressor that made the cycling of the bolt louder than the bullet. I pulled up an overhead image on a tablet that showed the thread of the road leading to the cottage. I said, "Okay, the house is about 4 miles away. Brett and Nick will lead." I used a pen to point on the tablet. "Head down this asphalt road and get a feel for what we're looking at, but don't penetrate the second gate where the gravel road starts. Peel off before becoming engaged and use the bikes to get into the woods. We know Billings has a diplomatic security team there, and I don't want any shooting. Give me an assessment and we'll follow up." Knuckles and Jennifer will park on the outside road, then enter slowly. I'll have out a U.S. flag, and we'll sort it from there. Beamer guys pull security while we check it out. I got an up and we rolled. 8 minutes later, we were tucked into a turnout, waiting on the motorcycles to report. When they did, I found out they'd rolled right up to the second gate, ignoring my orders. Obviously, they'd already sorted it out. Brett came on saying, "Bring it in, Pike, it's a mess." "Roger that. What did you tell them?" "I said we're Department of Homeland Security. Stick with that for now. They're too shell-shocked to ask for identification." We came upon a disaster scene, meeting a guy in mirrored shades who was acting like he was calm and collected. But I could see right through that. He was shaken. We retreated to the house, and we learned the damage. Two Arabs had somehow managed to kidnap the United States Secretary of State. The diplomatic security guys were giving us the information we needed, not hiding anything, which was surprising, because somebody was going to get annihilated for this goat fuck. There were 5 dead in the house, all stacked neatly in the bedroom with sheets covering them. 4 were diplomatic security. 1 was Haider al-Attiyah. 1 other man was barely conscious, his arm a pretzel, with Brett providing him medical attention. Leslie, the assistant, gave us the best information. When she was done talking, I said, "Why did you guys release the Range Rover?" The DSS man said, "Because the Secretary of State demanded it. We'd already scrubbed it. There was no threat, and we sent a man with them." I pointed to the bedroom and said, "One of those guys?" "Yes." "How did they get out?" "They shot their way out. They came blazing to the gate and just started shooting. There isn't any cover out there. We couldn't return effective fire without harming Secretary Billings." "And your cars? The up-armored vehicles?" "They were parked at the cottage. When we got to them, we found them disabled." Beating these guys up further was doing no good at all. I said, "How long ago? How much of a gap?" "Less than 20 minutes. So the slaying had occurred while we were on the road, making me regret pulling over to the side and waiting on Blaine. I said, "All right, we don't know what those guys are up to, but it's either murdering Billings or harming the peace talks. I need you to go through state and lock down that site. Call off the rest of today's activities and get them out of there." "What are you going to do?" I continued as if I hadn't heard him. "You got this scene. Call who you need to. At the State Department and the embassy, get anyone who needs treatment, medical care, but don't call the police. I don't need a bunch of gunslingers running amok with the sex state's life in the balance. We'll take it from here for Secretary Billings." He said, "Whoa, wait a minute. That's bullshit. Secretary Billings is my responsibility." I appreciated the sentiment, but that wasn't going to happen. I wasn't taking a bunch of unknowns. "You've got your hands full here. It looks like you're one of the last men standing. And this is what we do. Someone needs to coordinate with the embassy, and it isn't going to be Leslie." He nodded, accepting the information, then said, "I don't even know who you guys are. We're just another agency, but the other side of the coin. You protect defensively. We do so offensively. We've been tracking the Arabs." He said, "So I guess we both fucked this up." I took that in and then said, "Yeah, we did. We both trusted Billings's judgment."
Chapter 86. Khalid saw a parking garage built into the side of a hill, an office building made of glass attached to it, and said, "Pull in there, get off the street." Sabur made the turn, going underground into the darkness. Things had happened so quickly that Khalid needed time to think, to determine his next course of action. The drive out of the cottage had been a blur of gunfire and fear, Sabur plowing through the men at the gate as Khalid fired out the window, Billings cowering in the front seat in abject terror. He remembered only short glimpses, like the flash of a camera, the security man slamming into the car frame as the bullets stitched his chest, the brass from his MP7 ricocheting inside the car as they raced out, the look of shock on the men's faces at the gate. Only one fired back, until someone screamed at him to stop, and then they were through, turning onto the main road hard enough to throw Khalid against the opposite seat. They'd crossed the Gloma River and entered the peninsula of Frederikstad City, Sabur staying on Highway 110 until he swung through a traffic circle and began driving on surface streets. Khalid had swiveled his head back and forth, but nobody seemed to be paying them any mind. Even so, when the vehicle disappeared into the underground garage, Khalid felt relief in the darkness. Sabur killed the engine without pulling into a spot. He said,
"What now?"
Khalid wiped the sweat from his brow and said, "We go to the peace meetings. We complete the mission. Billings sat up and spoke for the first time. Khalid, you cannot succeed. You didn't kill everyone, so they'll be coming. They will have shut down the meetings. Give yourself up. Khalid cuffed him on the back of the head with the barrel of the weapon. Shut up. You will take us to the meeting right now. Billings cradled his head, saying, Why? Why must you do this? What possible good will it do? You will never understand. Take me to the meeting. No. Khalid raised his weapon, jamming the barrel into Billings's mouth. Killing you won't be harming the peace process, but it will be close enough. He saw Billings's phone flash on his hip, the vibrating buzz filling the interior. Nobody moved. Khalid said, Don't you dare answer that. It finished, leaving them in silence. Khalid said, I'm going to count to five. You nod when you want me to stop. If I reach five, I'm blowing the back of your head out. Billings closed his eyes. Khalid said, One. Punctuating it by jabbing the barrel and tearing Billings's lip. Two. Billings nodded. Khalid withdrew the barrel. Good choice. He handed his smartphone to Sabor and said, Pull up Google Maps, then hand the phone to the secretary. Billings said, I'll take you there. I just said I would. No, you'll tag the spot on the map. Then we'll drive there together. Resigned, Billings took the phone. He marked a location and handed it back. Khalid said, A museum? The talks are happening in a museum? Yes, it's government-controlled and on a fortified island. You won't get in. We will with you. He leaned into the back and withdrew the hidden CZ-75, handing it to Sabor. Switch seats. Billings drives now. They did so, and Khalid held up the phone. If you deviate from the route, I'll kill you. He saw a single headlight beam flash against the wall and said, When this motorcycle passes, we go. It took a moment before it registered that the motorcycle was coming down the exit ramp on the opposite side of the garage from the entrance they had used.
Chapter 87. I studied the satellite image on the tablet, the rest of the team forming a circle around me in the van, all of us waiting on a complete triangulation from the Rockstar bird. If it proved correct, the vehicle was in a parking garage just off a street called Sankroigata, in the heart of downtown Fredrikstad. We'd left behind the snow-covered fields and copses of barren trees in the countryside for the stone and steel of the Norwegian city. Initially, we knew only two things. The vehicle was a Range Rover, and it had taken a right on Highway 110, headed towards the Glomma River. I'd loaded everyone up, but intended to learn much more than that fact. We hadn't found Billings' cell phone in the house, so I was assuming it was still on his person. I'd first called Billings direct, and had gotten nothing but voicemail. I'd then called Blaine, demanding he launch my bird and load Billings' cell phone markers into the electronic surveillance package in the nose. Believe it or not, initially I'd received pushback, because Secretary Billings was a United States citizen, and the task force charter was forbidden from tracking AMSITs or otherwise interfering in their electronic communication, unless they had been designated a global terrorist. It was absolutely ridiculous. My first thought, given what Billings had done, was to push for a designation, but I knew that was going nowhere. The Oversight Council rapidly cleared up the idiocy, but I was going to make a pilot suffer over the delay. The bird made one pass over the city and pinged on the phone downtown, with a circle of probable error of about 700 meters. We moved in that direction. By the time we'd gotten to the city center, he'd pinged a second time on a different trajectory, and necked it down to the parking garage, but still with a 100-meter circle of probable error. That could put Billings inside the office building next door, or in a patch of scrub across the street near the river. but I was planning against him being in the garage. From the satellite photo, it had a separate entrance and exit, with the entrance on our street and the exit a block up to the south. Street view showed it to be at most two levels, and from the width, it wouldn't take a whole lot to search. First, I wanted to isolate our target. Both the entrance and exit had drop bars, but they wouldn't stop my motorcycle posse. I decided to send them to the exit, basically having them come in the wrong way to prevent us from missing our target if they drove out while we came in. Then Knuckles and I would enter normally, while Jennifer would park her van near the entrance, sealing it off after we went down, protecting us from discovery. I needed to collapse on the crisis site with overwhelming force, which would necessitate positively identifying the vehicle without arousing suspicion. A tough call considering at least one of the men in the vehicle knew both Knuckles and me by sight, and I wasn't sure whether Brett and Nick had also been compromised. I hoped the helmets they wore would camouflage our intent. I gave out the orders and asked for questions. Nick said, "What do you want us to do if we see the vehicle and can assault? Call first or seize the initiative?" I said, "Do what you think is right. The priority here is rescuing Secretary Billings. If you get down there and can do it, execute. If not, give me a call." Brett said, "Rules of engagement? Hostile force. Both Arabs are designated enemy combatants. Don't worry about imminent threat to you. If you see one in your sights and his back is turned, drop him. I don't care if you see a weapon or not." Brett nodded and said, "Roger that." My phone rang. It was the pilot. "Final pass complete. Do you have the data, or do I need to go around again?" I looked at the tablet screen, and the little green icon had shifted, about a millimeter. They were in the garage. I said, "I got it. You're cleared to depart." I held up the tablet and said, "That's them. Let's roll." We gave Brett and Nick time to circle the block. Then, Knuckles put the sedan in drive, inching forward. Jennifer behind us. My radio crackled. "Pike, Pike, this is Veep. We're entering now." Knuckles took a ticket and our drop bar opened. We stayed on the pressure pad waiting. Nick called again. "Pike, we're in, and I can see the vehicle. Range Rover sitting in the middle, three heads inside." We rolled forward, sliding into the darkness. We reached the bottom of the ramp and the headlights of the motorcycles illuminated a late model green Range Rover, three heads in silhouette. I recognized Billings in the driver's seat. All elements, Billings is driving. Hostiles are in passenger seats. Blood, Veep, lock down the front, we'll take the rear. We're going to get the jump on them, I thought. I saw the bikes coming forward, still about 50 meters away, and I climbed into the back of the sedan, cracking open the left side door, getting ready to leap out when Knuckles came abreast. Then the enemy decided to vote. While we were still 30 meters away, the rear passenger door of the Rover opened, the window already down. A man crouched behind and began spraying rounds toward my men. I saw one of the bikes go down, and the other goosing the throttle into the parked cars, the rider diving off into cover. I leapt out, seeing the Range Rover jerk forward, spinning one motorcycle out of the way and racing up the exit ramp, shattering the drop bar at the top. "What the hell is Billings doing?" I thought. I rolled and swung up my weapon. The Arab dove into our row of cars, and I recognized him. It was the one I'd fought in the park, now on the loose with a weapon. Knuckles dove out of the passenger side of our car into the parallel row across the garage. I said on the radio, "Target is on my side, my side." I heard, "This is blood, Veep's hit." I heard the Arab shuffling forward one car over, trying to escape. I leapt up on the hood and scanned the other side, expecting to see him crouched low. He was right in front of me, so close our barrels clanged together as he whirled to fire. I squeezed off two rounds just as he slapped my weapon aside, the bullets slicing into the car behind. I dove on top of him, ripping his MP7 out of his hands. We both rolled upright, with only one of us holding a weapon, me. He leapt to his feet and I rose as well, barrel on his chest. I was a millisecond from squeezing the trigger when I heard Knuckles shout, "No, we need his intel!" I realized he'd had him in his sights when I jumped onto the hood. The Arab was standing with his arms raised, waiting on the bullet. I kept my weapon on him and said, "Get on your fucking knees!" He just snarled at me. I said, "You want a shot at the title, little man?" And he charged right at me, spitting in rage. By all rights, I should have pulled the trigger, but I didn't. I dropped my weapon on its sling, and he began throwing punches. I blocked every one, batting them away like he was a child, letting him get close and wrap his arms around me for a takedown. He tried locking his leg behind me, just like he'd done in the park, but there was an enormous difference between me being surprised and me being ready. I sidestepped it, grabbed his hair, and headbutted him, slamming my forehead like a pile driver right above the nose. His arms turned to rubber, the fight completely gone. I kicked his legs out from underneath him and dropped him on his back looking for Knuckles. The entire episode, from the time the door of the Range Rover had opened until I dropped him, had taken maybe 45 seconds. Knuckles reached me and said, "I can't believe you didn't pull the trigger." "What? You just said we needed the intel and you were right behind me. I was in no danger." He shook his head, zip-tying the Arab's arms and legs, muttering, "Just embarrassed about that fight in the park." Which was true. I said, "Brett, give me a status." "Veep's got an in and out on his right thigh and a nick in his bicep, nothing life-threatening." Knuckles finished searching the Arab, holding up a cell phone. On it was a map with a blinking blue marble. I recognized the site. The Old Town Frederickstad Museum, where the peace talks were being held.
Chapter 88. Billings felt the bile rise in his throat, as if he'd had too much to drink and wouldn't be able to hold it in. But he kept driving, mainly because of the barrel in his gut. After all that had occurred, he was on autopilot. The man to his right seemed to have no fear whatsoever, and Billings had no idea what he intended to do once he arrived at the peace talks. Run inside with a pistol, shooting like he was a madman in Paris? Shout obscenities at the moon? The guy was crazy. One thing was sure, he was absolutely calm, almost serene. Whatever he had planned, it wasn't spur of the moment. Even though the old town and the museum were right on the banks of the Gloma, a stone's throw away from the parking garage, they'd had to retrace their steps, going back up the 110 to the large traffic circle miles away. Then turn right, basically making a box to get into the ancient fort, as there was only one road that a vehicle could traverse. The town was literally a defensive encampment from ages ago, with an actual moat that slashed out in a zigzag pattern around the village, which, due to restoration and upkeep, looked much like it had eons ago. And it was the reason the location had been chosen, a single choke point to defend against threats. Throughout the drive, Billings had thought about his options, telling himself to fight, wrestle for the pistol, or jump out, letting the man shoot at him as he ran away. In the end, he simply couldn't bring himself to do so. His rational mind said there were better options. There were armed men at the talks, security guards even on the main road. There was no way the Arab would be able to penetrate anywhere dangerous. As soon as Billings got the chance, he'd raise the alarm and they'd take the man down. In retrospect, his biggest mistake had been flooring the accelerator in the garage. He had no idea what had happened there. One minute they were discussing moving to the peace talks. The next minute, Khalid was blazing away at two motorcycles to his front. It was insane. When the man in the passenger seat had screamed at him to go, he'd reacted out of instinct, wanting to get away from the gunfire. But he now wondered if they hadn't been police trying to help him. Did he now look like he was complicit in whatever these evildoers had planned? The Arab said, "Slow down, checkpoint ahead." In the words, Billings realized how much he'd been duped. Hyder had said the man spoke no English, but that too was a lie. He looked forward and saw the spit of land that stretched over the moat, lined with trees. In front was a chicane of three concrete blocks, and two men standing near a warming barrel, bundled up in the cold, weapons slung. He thought,
"This is it. This is when it ends."
Sabor said, "If you get us through this, you will live." Billings felt the sweat break out on his head. He pulled forward and rolled down his window. The first guard began running a mirror under the frame of the truck, and the next one said, "May I see your registration, please?" Billings looked shocked at the question. He had no idea what to say, no idea who the vehicle was registered to. Sabor dug through the glove box with his left hand, his right hidden. He held out the registration. The security guard said, "Sir, are you all right?" Billings wiped his upper lip and said, "I'm fine, just fine." Reading the registration, he asked, "What is your name?" Billings started to answer when the pistol went off right in front of his face, the bullet snapping the guard's head back, and the sound exploding in Billings's ears. Billings screamed, and the Arab rotated, shooting the second guard through the passenger window. The guard whirled, then fell to the ground, and started crawling away, scrambling for his rifle on his back, clearly not mortally wounded. Sabor leapt out, stalked over to him, put the barrel against the back of his head, and pulled the trigger. Even with the events of the last few hours, the act of violence shocked Billings. Sabor returned to the vehicle and said, "Get in the passenger seat." Billings obeyed, and Sabor came around, entering the driver's seat. He locked the doors, then switched on the parental controls, preventing Billings from opening his side. He reached underneath his seat, pulling out a metal case the size of a cigarette package. He flipped up a cover and flicked a switch from off to on. Billings said,
"What is that thing?"
"Your ticket to paradise."
The Arab put the vehicle in drive and crossed the moat.
Chapter 89. I handed the phone back to Knuckles, saying, "Check those bikes out, see if they still run." I clicked my radio and said, Blood, this is Pike, you've got Xville. Get the hostel and Veep out of here. Coco, you copy?" She said, "Coming down." Brett said, "No issues, I got Veep stabilized one row over. Where's the hostel?" "Right next to the sedan. I can't stay here with him. We need to move." "Roger all. What'll I tell Showboat? Where are you headed?" "To find a Range Rover." I called Blaine on the phone, waiting for it to encrypt. I told him what had transpired, and that I needed a cleanup crew at my location. I gave him the data in clinical terms, and then ended with what I thought was happening. "I believe that vehicle is a VBIED. I think they intend to drive it right into the peace talks and set it off." "You sure about that?" "I think this is something to do with Billings, a hostage thing. Why on earth would they set off a car bomb at the peace talks? They're from Qatar." "I don't know. Middle East agendas are impossible to sort out. Why does ISIS behead members of Al-Qaeda? Why does the Taliban fight ISIS? It's not worth finding a motive. That's what I think's happening." "Do you have any proof?" "No, no smoking gun. But we got a guy here you can put the screws to." "That'll take too long. If you're right, we need to get moving." "We called, but they wouldn't shut down the talks based on the actions at the cottage. All they did was put up a checkpoint outside the moat. You can still get through without any special identification. They aren't stopping tourist traffic, but they'll flag anyone strange." "Get the word out about the vehicle. Tell them it's a Range Rover." "I will, but it won't happen quickly, especially if they're inbound." "I've looked at the map, and I can beat them there. They'll have to go far out of their way to get to the village in that vehicle. Thank God Norway actually chose a fortified one for the talks. I've got a couple of bikes that will probably make it on the footpaths. I can get across the bridge, and we're cutting straight through the fields. There's a single path on the river. If we can use that, we'll go straight to the museum, giving them our intel personally. What about Billings? Sir, he was driving the damn vehicle. If he'd have sat here in the garage, he'd be free, and we'd be looking at victory. He's the one that hauled ass out of here. My concern now is the peace talks and the innocents there. Once I get them on board, I'll look at pulling his ass out of the fire. I heard nothing. I said, sir? Okay, that makes sense. Just stick with the saving innocence and drop the he's a jackass if this goes bad. I saw Nick getting loaded and said, I'll call when I can. Jennifer came over to me and said, we're ready to go. You need a hand? No. Brett's not taking a hostel and a WIA by himself. He's going to need some help. This is just a Paul Revere ride to warn the locals that the bad guys are coming. She squinted her eyes at me, sensing there was more. I said, get out of here before someone wants to know what the loud noises were down here. She pecked me on the lips and said, don't do anything stupid. Do I ever? She got in the van and pulled away. Knuckles said, both bikes will function. One's banged up pretty good, but all he did was ding the engine cage and gas tank. Let's go. He propped his bike up and said, we doing something stupid? More than likely. We crossed the bridge across the Gloma, and I immediately began looking for our own create-on-the-fly off-ramp. I found it a quarter mile in, when I saw a makeshift footpath snaking down through the snow, the chain-link fencing cut away by pedestrians, looking for a way to get to the river without walking 2 miles and turning around. I pointed, and Knuckles flicked his head, telling me to go. I stopped the bike and threaded it through the chain link, pushing with my feet, seeing the drop down the slope. It was a little hairy, especially in the snow. Cars were staring at me like I was about to perform a stunt, which I suppose I was. I didn't look like a touring rider, that's for sure. I had the bike, but no jacket, boots, or helmet. One man honked the horn, and Knuckles waved, waiting on me. I said, maybe we should look a little further on where it's not as steep. Knuckles grinned and said, maybe you should do a little more mobility training. I saw his head swivel, and I followed his gaze. From our height, we could see the entire town and the moat surrounding it. Out in the distance, there was a single vehicle coming down the small ribbon of road that led to the tourist town. It was our Range Rover. If I'd had a helmet, I would have slammed the visor down with authority, then skid down the slope in wild abandon. I opted just for the skidding, riding the back brake and letting gravity take its toll. I hit the bottom and waited for Knuckles to catch up. When he did, I said, we need to hit it. They'll be inside the perimeter of the town in seconds. We get in, you cut north. I'll head to the museum. You track him. Let me know how much time I have. Got it, let's go. The town was really nothing more than a simple grid, with about as many buildings as would be expected from a 15th century construction. It wasn't large at all, and standing on any one road, a person would be able to clearly see the far perimeter, which meant, once he was inside, we had very little time. I hit the gas, throwing out the snowy mud before hitting the pavement, then went as fast as I dared on the asphalt. We raced to the river, hitting a dock and a small footpath. I went left, now restricted from gunning the engine. The footpath widened and I opened the throttle. We were past the moat. Ahead of me, I saw a small cluster of people selling wares in what looked like an artist's colony, a bunch of painters and pottery builders. I couldn't get through them on the bike. I slowed and dismounted, saying, please let me through. They gave me a startled look, since this definitely wasn't a motorcycle track. One man stood up and waved his hands, an older hippie-looking guy speaking Norwegian. I pushed the bike forward and reached a parallel street that dead-ended against a small picket fence. I glanced up and saw the Range Rover pass a street. A brief glimpse, but I saw it. The VBIED was on the island. I threw myself over the saddle, saying on the radio, they're in, then goosed the engine, shouting, get the fuck out of the way! I let the clutch out and went ripping through the tables and stalls, not really caring what I hit. I saw plaster and canvas flying left and right, people screaming and diving. And then I was through. The footpath turned to asphalt and I increased speed. I passed the sally port on the riverside of the town and flicked a hand out, telling Knuckles to take it. I heard his bike's whine disappear. I continued on. The museum was the furthest building on the south end of the town, and I'd seen the Range Rover entering from the center. They were going to beat me. I shifted gears, the bike now almost out of control. The end of the town appeared, the asphalt turning to dirt again. I hammered the brakes, twisted the wheel, and slid into the turn. Ahead of me, at the east end of the road, was the Range Rover, the old garrison wall of the museum, the only protection for the men inside. In between us was the cul-de-sac entrance to the courtyard of the museum. I saw a large group of people milling around a bunch of town cars and SUVs, a platoon of earpiece-wearing security interspersed amongst them, completely oblivious to the threat bearing down. This is it. I thought through my options. Reach the men? Shouting at them to run? Drive forward, guns blazing like a movie? Or just sit because I was too late? I saw Knuckles turn the corner behind the Range Rover, still going strong. Shit, I thought. I gunned the engine and popped the clutch, racing straight at the grill in an insane game of chicken. I caught only a snippet when I passed the open cul-de-sac, a brief glimpse of men scrambling and reaching for weapons. Then I was past. We closed together until I could see Billings' horrified face and the steely eyes of the Arab driving, and I laid the bike down, sending it straight in front of the Rover. I bounced on the ground, skipping on the asphalt, and the Arab jerked the wheel, avoiding the bike and careening up onto the old grass fortifications on the other side of the road. The Range Rover fought for traction on the grade, eventually failing. It groaned for a minute, two wheels off the ground, then flipped, sliding to a stop on the passenger side. Knuckles right behind it. He leapt off his bike, running to the passenger side to kill the Arab. He still thinks Billings is driving, I thought. I knew different. I screamed at him. And he reversed. I saw the Arab frantically searching the floor. He raised something up, and Knuckles took the shot. 1, 2, 3, 4. Straight through the windshield. The man slumped over. Knuckles remained still. I slowly stood, hearing the men starting to react from behind the walls of the old museum. I felt a wicked pain in my left leg, but I could walk. I heard someone shout from inside the vehicle. I shuffled forward, reaching Knuckles. Inside, Billings was moaning like he was in labor, and I thought it pretty fitting. He'd given birth to the biggest fuck-up I'd ever been involved in. Knuckles said, "You okay?" "I don't know. Too early. Let the adrenaline wear off." Knuckles saw movement and snapped his head to the windshield. He shouted, "No, sir. No, no, no. Remain still." I turned around and saw Billings trying to climb out, over the top of the dead man, his foot kicking the detonator the Arab had held. Knuckles screamed, "Don't fucking move! Stop what you're doing!" I grabbed Knuckles and bodily threw him over the old berm, diving after him. We hit the ground behind an abutment that had been protecting soldiers for over 500 years, and the vehicle went off, an enormous, earth-shattering explosion. The sky rained metal, the thumps and dings crashing amongst the trees, the smoke and heat from the explosion flowing over us. I could hear nothing, the overblast still punching through me. After a second or two, Knuckles groaned and rolled over. I did the same, then grabbed his shoulder and said, "You okay?" He shook his head, looked at me and said, "That didn't work like we wanted." I flopped back down and said, "Bullshit. I'm still breathing." Chapter 90. Lying on the couch, nursing my wounds, I heard the bell ring and said, "Jen, can you get that?" She came out and saw me flopped like a beached walrus. She said, "How long are you going to milk this? It's been 3 weeks." I said, I didn't see you getting blown up. She said, guess you're still mostly dead. Should I look through your clothes for loose change? I smiled at the Miracle Max reference and said, as you wish. She rolled her eyes and said, car bomb goes off and I never hear the end of it. Hey, I haven't been milking it. I've been doing my fair share around here. She reached the door and said, really? That's what you call last night, your fair share? I squinted at her, because certain things really did still hurt. But she ignored me, answering the door. I saw Kylie Hale, Kurt's niece, along with someone on crutches behind her. I knew who it was. I finally rose. Veep, come on in. Kylie came in before him, speaking in a stern voice. Seriously? You expect a warm welcome? You recruit him and then get him shot? I said nothing, simply holding out my arms, and she let me wrap her up. When I realized she wasn't going to kick my nuts, I said, no, come on. I didn't get him shot. He walked in front of a bullet. She leaned back and said, I'm talking to my uncle about this. Don't think I won't. I shook Nick's hand and said, talk all you want. From what I hear, he's been cleared by the Oversight Council for future operations. She said, against my wishes. I looked at Nick and said, well, I heard his father threw his hat in the ring for president, so you should expect a little bit out of the son. I saw him flush. He said, Pike, about that garage thing? I don't think Brett told you after everything was done. He saw the door open. He pulled on the guy, and I was still moving. I blocked his shot, I cut him off. Jesus, you are one glutton for punishment. Are you seriously saying you deserve to be shot? Nobody, no matter what, ever says that shit. When Brett shows up, I expect for you to say he got you shot because he didn't trust his aim enough to pull the trigger. Nick looked over my shoulder and said, speak of the devil. Brett came in, walking right into Jennifer. He hugged her and said, mighty nice digs. Didn't expect this from Pike. She said, what on earth does Pike have to do with our place? He laughed, knowing it was true. I said, well, nobody else in here is dealing with the mice invasion. She keeps trying to catch them, and that's failed. The conversation was loose and fun, but it was a thin veneer for why we were together. A brittle layer that everyone was afraid of cracking. But it had to happen sooner or later. That was the point. Knuckles walked in, waving a bottle of Jameson whiskey. I said, what the hell is that? We drink Bacardi. He hugged me, then Jennifer, and said, we drink what Guy drinks. And the brittle layer was cracked. I said, yeah, you're right. Just waiting on one. But serve them up. The end state of the mission wasn't exactly textbook, but Guy George had been right all along. If anyone had listened to him to begin with, the rest of the sloppy mess wouldn't have occurred. The task force had, as I'd thought, declined to do our usual memorial for fallen members. I didn't blame them, since Guy's actions had in fact jeopardized everything we stood for. But I'd be damned if he wasn't getting one. I'd planned my own. I'd wanted to do it in D.C., at our traditional haunt like we always did, right after his burial in Arlington. But Kurt had said it was poking a sore. Make no mistake, he sympathized. But he had one more on his plate with the death of the Secretary of State than I could ever comprehend. He didn't tell me no, but I got the message. I planned it for my own house in Charleston, South Carolina, with only the team. Well, the team and one other. We'd managed to escape Norway intact, but it was a close-run thing. The chaos of the exploding Range Rover helped, of course, but the rental agreements on the motorcycles had hurt. Knuckles and I had escaped traversing a footpath on the other side of the berm, never engaging any of the security or the follow-on police forces, leaving the bikes where they lie. The fallout, irrespective of Billings' death, was as messy as I'd ever seen, and we'd been cut off from all operations for the near term while the might of the United States government went into damage control. So far, they'd managed to explain away a lot of things with innuendo and bullshit. The attack on the cottage had helped, but that too was hampered by blabbermouths. I didn't pay attention, because I thought the entire mission was a disaster from the get-go. For the first time ever, I let the Oversight Council sort it out. They made the mess. They could clean it up. Knuckles poured the shots, and the doorbell rang again. The final invitee. I opened the door and saw Carly standing with her arms crossed, looking over the balcony. I said, "You made it. I hoped you would." She turned around and smiled. "I wouldn't miss it. Thank you for the invite." I said, "Thank Jennifer." For me, it was only returning the favor. She came inside and said, "Trust me, that'll never happen again." After the garage hit, Jennifer and Brett had transferred Khalid to Task Force Control. Our data from the thumb drive, coupled with his interrogation, had buried the QIA official known as Sharif Al-Attiya. He was a bad, bad man. Well, he was a respected member of the Qatar government. But once we introduced his transgressions into our liaison system through the CIA, the government immediately considered him a bad, bad man. Like those fucks weren't doing the same thing all the time anyway. CIA had taken the ball at that point, tracking Sharif to Istanbul, Turkey. They'd asked for his transfer back to Qatar, and the Turkish intelligence guys had balked, asking for Qatar to formally request him. Of course, the Qatar government wasn't going to officially request his arrest, as the information that he'd been complicit in killing the Secretary of State would be explosive. And so, we'd been called in. Well, more precisely, a rendition flight had been, along with some coordination with unsavory Turkish characters. Carly had asked and been given permission to run the repatriation, and because of task force involvement, she'd requested me to be included as an observer. It was really not a high-speed thing, but it was satisfying. We'd flown to Istanbul with a bunch of CIA black-clad ninjas, none who would say a word. We exited the aircraft, drove to a hangar, and met some unknown Turkish thugs. In the trunk of a car, they had Sharif, wearing zip ties and a hood. We took him, put him on the plane, and landed in Doha, Qatar. When we'd removed the hood, he saw the man we were turning him over to, and we walked away hearing him screaming his innocence. Nobody said a word when the screams were cut off by a slap. It wasn't our business. We were just delivery people. 20 minutes later, we were back in the air. We'd landed in Washington, D.C., and I'd said goodbye to the ninjas. They still hadn't said a word. Even given that, it had been enjoyable. I kissed Carly on the cheek and handed her a glass of whiskey. She took it, and I turned to the room. "Everyone's now here. For Guy." They all said, "For Guy." I raised the glass and said, "May he rest in peace." Carly started to respond in the same, but was drowned out with, "Peace is an illusion. May he continue to fight." She looked at me, then Jennifer, who was drinking her whiskey. I said, "Just tradition." She downed her own glass and said, "I think he'd like that." I said, "Lord knows Guy's said it enough." Jennifer came over, her eyes wet because she was a softie for this sort of thing. Carly said, "Kurt called me today, out of the blue. Somehow he knew I was in the United States." With mock surprise, I said, "Who would have told him that?" "He wants to talk to me, and I think I know what it's about." I caught movement out of the corner of my eye, on the counter. A flash of brown. I said, "Not tonight. I don't want to do business tonight. This is for Guy. Jennifer, go take her and show her girl things. She'd rather talk to you." Jennifer smiled and said, "Actually, I'd love to. I'm sick of being the only woman in the room." Carly asked, "You're really always the only female?" Well, there's this crazy lesbian assassin we sometimes work with, but I'm not sure she counts. Carly had no idea what to make of that. I said, Jennifer's just aggravated because she likes me more than her. Jennifer rolled her eyes and said, well, how do you get through the door with a head that big? She shouted, Kylie, let's go to the porch. Leave the testosterone zone. They went through the door and I turned, seeing the bane of my existence, that damn mouse chewing on a beer cap of all things. Brett was laughing at a joke, and I waved my hand, quieting the room. I slowly opened the drawer. I pulled out the meat tenderizer and inched forward, solely focused on my prey. I didn't hear Knuckles tap on the sliding glass door, getting Jennifer's attention. Didn't see his grin. A red Solo cup slapped into the side of my head. I heard, Pike, don't you dare.
The End. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Forgotten Soldier, a Pike Logan thriller by Brad Taylor. Narrated by Henry Strozier with Rich Orlow as Pike Logan. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.